Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast about agriculture and medicine with an emphasis on biotechnology and the good things it can do for people and a planet. My name's Kevin Folta. I'm a professor at the University of Florida, one of your top 10 public universities. Wahoo. Today, it's a little bit different. We're not going to talk about biotechnology per se, but we're going to talk about food technology. And more appropriately, really the manifestations of food technology when we talk about obesity and other chronic health issues associated with consumption of maybe the wrong kind of calories or too many calories. We'll talk about that with our guest today. So our guest is Anthony Warner, and you may know Anthony from his blog, The Angry Chef, which he's been doing since 2016. But he's written two books, at least two that I'm aware of, and I adored the first one, and I was very fortunate to read the second. And he's with us today. So welcome to the podcast, Anthony.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, nice to talk to you finally. We've communicated on Twitter and social media for a few years now, and nice to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's been something we've been trying to get together for a while, isn't it? And we've finally done it.
Yeah, finally made it happen. Now, I know that what makes your work particularly compelling to me is because you have a background in science. So where did you train and what did you study?
I studied biochemistry at Manchester University. I graduated in the mid-1990s, and I didn't necessarily go into follow a field connected to that degree. I became a chef straight after university and worked for many years in restaurants and hotels, and then subsequently worked for the food manufacturing industry, which meant I engaged a lot more with dietitians and nutritionists and re-engaged with the science a little bit.
And what kind of stuff did you do with the industry? Like, what was that job?
I was a development chef, so a creative development chef, making new products for the food industry. So mostly for grocery products like pasta sauces and things like that. So I'd create the recipes and do some of the creativity and some of the innovation and work on bringing new products to market in the UK grocery market.
Did you find that your experience as a biochemist gave you a certain understanding of food and food chemistry that really made you a much better chef?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's certainly, the big challenges in the food industry are often sort of diet and health and nutrition and understanding nutrition science. And obviously a background in food in science helped sort of me have some sort of credibility in the sort of conversations I was having to have about nutrition and diet and health. And also, with the fact that this is industrially produced food, often there are questions of scientific questions that need addressing in the cooking.
I guess the other really important part of this conversation before we dive into the new book is maybe touching on the first book, which I thought was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And it really was much more of an extension of your blog and your persona of, here's all of the misinformation that's out there. Let's take it apart. And just so the audience can become a little more familiar with who you are and what you've done, if they don't know your work, can you give us a little synopsis about, what the first book was about and what your, and maybe an example or two of some of the debunking that you did inside that text?
Yeah, I mean, the first book was very much based, as you said, on my blog, which was really sort of debunking bad science in the world of food. It was kind of a reaction to a lot of the often internet-based pseudoscience that I was seeing sort of coming along, and like various fad diets, which were gaining in popularity and certain gaining sort of popularity in certain little areas of the internet. So things like clean eating diets, things like the paleo diet, things like the alkaline NASH diet, and all these ridiculous pseudoscientific dietary fads, which weren't really being challenged. And I felt there was a need to sort of challenge them online, and then that became very popular very quickly because I think there was a big appetite for people to sort of fight back against this very sort of guilt-inducing, almost anti-food sort of dietary debunking, persuading people to go on very restrictive diets, which I felt was very harmful. And then the book was kind of an extension of that. But what the book covers various fad diets, but it also you know, my fascination is why we're so susceptible to this stuff, especially when it comes to food, which I imagine is something you're interested in as well. When it comes to food, it's incredibly emotive, and it's incredible. There's an incredible amount of pseudoscience connected to that area, and I was fascinated why that was the case, and really getting to the heart of why we're so inclined to false beliefs when it comes to food.
And that's really what I enjoyed about that first book was it really opened its doors to understanding things like the alkaline diet, which I've, you know, criticized forever. It's insane to even think that such a thing can work. And when they talked about, you know, years ago there was a sports magazine or something, a bicycle magazine or whatever I was reading, where they had this whole thing about the alkaline diet and then a gigantic centerfold for alkaline water. And I thought, okay, the advertisers are buying a little something here. But how can, you know, it made zero sense when you understand the ideas of chemistry and the pH of the stomach and buffering and all the concepts that are there. Yeah. And the neat part was when I read your book and I realized its roots and saw where it started. And it really gave it a really nice, like the alkaline ash diet, that whole thing, really gave a great overlay to understanding that better. And so really highly recommend the first book. But the second book, The Truth About Fat, is what I really hope to drill down on here today. And it really starts out with the idea that we're in an obesity epidemic, but also the other chronic health conditions associated with excess weight. And so can you give us a synopsis really of that stepping off point?
Yeah, I mean, the second book is quite different, I suppose, in that it's not necessarily attacking various specific fad diets and real pseudoscientific beliefs, but it's a sort of critical assessment of the way we talk about obesity and the way we talk about, you know, body weight and the way we talk about health and the relationships to health, and really sort of critically assessing everything in that arena, and particularly pulling apart the various people who are making a lot of money, to be honest, selling us simple solutions to what are really complex systemic issues. And that's the heart of it, is looking at every single person who's proposing that, you know, obesity, sort of health inequalities are simple things with simple solutions, because they're not. I think we all sort of know they're deeply complex systemic issues, but so many people are saying it's just simple. It's just the microbiome, or it's just our genes, or it's just because we don't exercise, or it's just because of this and that, and so the solution is simple. And the solution is not simple. It's a complex systemic issue. And we also have a lot of misinformation and a lot of misunderstandings about the obesity epidemic in general. I don't even like that. I try to put that term epidemic in inverted commas, because I personally think it's something different. But, you know, it's an exploration of all of that, which is obviously such a massive preoccupation that we all have. And I wanted to unpack it and understand, you know, the real misunderstandings that exist, and the people who are exploiting those misunderstandings and using that to make money. And that includes, you know, individuals, but it also includes businesses. It also includes the diet industry. It also includes, you know, large food companies who sell us health in a box, or sell us solutions, simple solutions, again, to complex problems. So it was really, you know, it explores lots of areas. It's quite a, you know, wide-ranging book, and hopefully comes to some sort of sensible conclusion somewhere near the end.
Well, what in your analysis, what is the role of carbohydrates in this? And, you know, so many people have framed these no-carb, low-carb diets. You know, how much reality is there? Because we know from biology that carbohydrates are the preferred energy source of the cell. And how does that really play into issues like, metabolic syndrome, et cetera? You know, when we have maybe leaning a little high on the carbohydrates from day to day.
Okay. It's very difficult. It's common practice to demonize carbohydrates, and it's become more and more common in the last few years. You just look at the evidence, and there's an extensive section in the book on fats and carbohydrates. You look at the evidence, and the fact that sort of there's a single lone cause or role for carbohydrates is pretty ridiculous. I mean, it's based on misinterpretations of science, and it's based on a science which is spread very much by, you know, the diet industry, so the Atkins diet and various, many, many people sort of supporting those sort of diets and making a lot of money selling those sort of diets. Because certainly if you cut all carbohydrates out of your diet, then you will probably enter into a more restricted eating pattern, then you'll probably lose some weight. And there's good evidence to say that it might be a potential strategy for some people to do that. But to say there's some specific reason why carbohydrates are causing metabolic harm, there's just no good evidence to support that. And I think there's an inherent problem with the way we like to think about food, which is that when it comes to diet and health, we like to demonize single ingredients. Like, we like to demonize sugar, we like to demonize carbohydrates, we like to demonize fat, we like to demonize saturated fat. And in my opinion, all those things are a flawed ways of approaching this issue. So, you know, because it's not about that. It's about the food that people eat and the way people consume food and the relationship they have with food and their, you know, the relationship they have with their bodies and the relationship they have with their health. And so to try and sort of single it down, it's just generally people trying to sell simple solutions to complex problems, like I said. And this idea that it's all about carbohydrates, it's just as flawed as the idea that it was all about fat. And it's just as flawed as the idea that it's all about exercise. You know, these are complex things, and we have to kind of look at the whole rather than focusing on individual things.
Well, the part of this that really gives me pause, and you talk about this being a larger systemic, multifaceted issue, and I'm with you 100%. But the thing that people leave out all the time is genetics. And when you look at the diversity of just, you know, the way we look and the way we think and everything about us, we also have different ways of metabolizing different parts of chemistry or metabolizing or building up different kinds of chemistry. We can see that in different people and the way we carry fat, carry weight in different places, whatever. And I know what works for me. And for me, and I don't like a lot of carbohydrates. They wear me out, and I do put on extra pounds when I tend to have more carbohydrates than what I'm associating with higher blood sugar. But that works for me. And when we start to apply what works for me to a population, it doesn't necessarily hold. And I think that's what we see a lot in this issues around discussions of food and fat. And how much do you think that one size fits all, that one common solution? It really is the cornerstone of most of this stuff, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I couldn't agree with that more. You know, we are incredibly genetically diverse. You know, we respond to food in different ways. And, you know, people have this tendency to look at their diet and what they do and think, if it worked for me, that's applicable to the rest of the population, despite the fact that the rest of the population are genetically different, they're socially different, you know, they lead completely different lives. You know, have completely different needs and completely different values. And you know, you're trying to apply the same thing to everyone is obviously ridiculous. And, you know, and body weight itself, you know, how much fat we store is incredibly highly genetically determined. When we have enough food to eat, then, you know, it's thought to be around about your body weight is thought to be around about 70% heritable, which is the same roughly as your height. But we have this idea that we must make everyone conform to be exactly the same shape and size. And if anyone's, you know, the wrong shape and size, they have to sort of starve themselves back into being what's considered a more ideal shape and size. And that is, you know, not only for many people fighting against their genetics, but it also is quite problematic because it can put people into a very difficult relationship with the food they eat and a very difficult relationship with their bodies. And, you know, I think this trying to apply a one size fits all, that we all have to eat the same way and we all have to look the same way and be the same shape and size, you know, is, you know, clearly ridiculous, but that's what the entire diet industry seems to be founded upon.
And I think it also is ignorant to a couple other simple basics of biology. And one of the concepts that you touch on is kind of this set point, you know, this place where your body wants to get with respect to the amount of weight that it carries or the amount of fat that it carries. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
That's something that's been known for quite a considerable amount of time. You know, back to sort of Ankle Keyes' starvation experiments in the 1940s, you know, he made a group of people lose a lot of weight, and it had a massive impact on them for all sorts of aspects of their physiology and their psychology, and was incredibly, you know, would never be repeated again because it's so harmful, even though it was just a slightly restricted diet for about six months. And they lost quite a considerable amount of their weight. But when they were refed, people got back to the weight they were at before. We kind of have a natural natural point where our weight tends to reach. That might increase a little bit every year for some people. You know, it might sort of change slightly, and you might have a, I think most people are more comfortable with this idea of sort of a settling point roughly within a few kilos or a few pounds either way. So if you go above that, your body would kind of like, and when you go outside that range, your body enacts lots of processes in order to bring you back into that range in terms of the amount of fat it has in storage. So, you know, and these processes, which are, you control it, mostly hormonal, they're very well known. They're quite recent, actually. You know, when I was studying biochemistry, 20 or so years ago, most of this stuff hadn't, well, no, 30 or so years ago, most of this stuff hadn't really been discovered. But now we have this knowledge of various hormones like leptin, which is controlled by the amount of fat you have in storage, and sort of ghrelin and various other hormonal systems, which keep us in very tight regulation, keeps our weight very tightly regulated, because, you know, most of us, our weight doesn't change that much day to day, week to week. It usually changes over a period of years if it changes. And that's just by a very different, very small difference in the amount of calories, between the amount of calories you eat and the amount of calories you burn. You know, and it's ridiculous to think that's controlled somehow by willpower. Most of it is controlled by homeostatic mechanisms in the body, which keep us in a particular weight. But we kind of have this idea when it comes to weight that it's very much part in sort of a control by our willpower, you know, that we sort of will ourselves to be a certain way, and that's really not true. The you know, one of the leading scientists in the world who discovered the hormone leptin, Jeffrey Friedman, he told me when I was writing the book, he told me, you know, when he's lecturing on this, he describes, you know, weight as being quite simply the same sort of our desire to eat. When we haven't, when we're losing weight, if we're hungry, our desire to eat is very much the same as our desire to breathe. You can fight it for a certain amount of time, and you can control it to an extent, but eventually, you know, your hormones, and it's governed by very much the same parts of the brain, your hormones will override that, and you will eat, you know, just as you will eventually breathe. It's sort of in your control, but, you know, it will eventually happen. You will have to gasp for breath. People will eventually eat. It just seems like it's within our willpower because it's happens over a much longer period of time than our desire to breathe or our desire to drink. All these processes are very, very tightly controlled by our hypothalamus, so the part of the brain which controls those sort of basic instincts.
I totally get that. And for me, you know, it's kind of funny. I don't know if you'd call it willpower, but for me, it's the lack of wanting to buy new clothes that keep me in a central weight. It's totally true. Like, I can tell when I go for, you know, go up for Christmas to my folks' house or something, and, you know, I go to Chicago and I eat a deep dish pizza, and then I eat 5 Italian beefs and hot dogs and all that stuff that I totally love that I never get. And so I have to eat all of it inside, you know, a few days time. And I can come back from that wing, you know, another, you know, 5 kilos more in, or, you know, 10 pounds more, no problem. And, but then I can tell because my clothes fit weird. And then I just, it kind of is like a tying a string around your finger, that I basically then start to think twice about, well, do I really need to have, you know, 3 beers tonight, or do I really need to eat, you know, some ice cream with that, you know? And I end up getting back down to my set point, which is about 204 pounds. And that's about where I always end up. And if I lose weight from too much exercise, or I'm, you know, really training hard back when I was, you know, running a ton and doing other exercise, I would get down to maybe 189, 190. But then as soon as I would, kind of loosen the training a touch, I'd get right back up to my normal weight. And I really do believe that there is a point where I am meant to be genetically. And I don't know that there's a sense in fighting that. But yeah, what about
all the evidence supports that? You know, it's not something the diet industry supports, because that would sort of mess with their business model. But all the evidence supports that is pretty much the case. And it gets ridiculous, because you'll get someone going into the doctors and they'll have, you know, a BMI of what, 35, 40. And the doctor will say you have to get your BMI down to 25 because that's what you need to do. But that's kind of a ridiculous question to have, as a conversation to have with a lot of people, because that's just an unachievable goal. You know, the goal should be to help people at the weight they are improve their health. You know, surely that should be the goal that all sort of health professionals are working towards. But this narrative about weight has become about sort of maintaining an ideal or a perfect weight that's the same for everybody has become so dominant that often the conversations with medical professionals are like, you know, here's this unachievable goal that you have to get to, and if you don't, then you won't be healthy. Rather than saying, here's how you are now, what can you do to improve your health? You know, exercise would be one thing, eating a better quality diet would be another, stopping smoking, not drinking as much, you know, actually a few of those things that you've mentioned, they're good ways to improve your health. They might not improve your weight. They probably, you know, there's some evidence exercise might move your set point down a little bit, but, you know, it might not. You might be willing to put weight on when you exercise. You might want to put muscle mass on. That would be a good thing for your health. But, you know, because of this obsession we have with weight, we get to some pretty strange places when it comes to health. People basically doing quite unhealthy behaviors in order to lose weight because they think that's what defines them as a sort of healthy person. You know, so people taking diet pills and even people smoking, you know, in order to lose weight. So, you know, we have this obsession with it. We have this obsession with normalizing everybody's body to the same, whereas I think we should probably just be worrying about, you know, improving people's health.
No, very good. So we're talking with Anthony Werner. He's the author of The Truth About Fat and also the book, The Angry Chef, and also the writer of the blog, One Angry Chef, and also a column. What's your column called in the Times?
It was the Angry Chef column in the Times when it's in there, yeah.
Okay.
In a food room.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to read that because I don't read the Times, but certainly that was another credit to you there. So we're on the Talking Biotech podcast, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Hey everyone, this is Nick Syke from No Ideas Media. If you listen to this podcast, you're probably an awesome person who's probably found themselves in a debate or two about the validity of genetic engineering and its use in food production. You may have even noticed the same problem I've been picking up on. There's lots of good information out there about genetic engineering, but very few people who need to see it are exposed to it. Well, I'm making videos that lay people like myself can actually understand and digest. I'm a filmmaker, so this is my contribution to science communication. They are the perfect thing to post on the wall of that friend you have. You know, that person who just can't seem to grasp the awesomeness of GE crops, who maybe gets hung up on things like chemicals or Monsanto or whatever. The videos I make cover a wide variety of topics, and you can watch them by searching No Ideas Media, remember that's No as in knowledge, on Facebook or YouTube. The videos will likely cover what you already know, but the point is, we gotta share them with people who don't know. The mission at No Ideas Media is to be pragmatic, not dramatic. So help us spread the right information about genetic engineering. Thanks a lot.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast today, talking with Anthony Werner, who you may know as the Angry Chef, who's written the book, The Truth About Fat. And it's a good book that really follows on the heels of one of my favorite books. First book was just The Angry Chef, right? That was the title.
Yeah. It's got a subtitle, Bad Science and the Truth About Healthy Eating.
There you go. Okay. And I love the the reviews that were the poll quotes of people who read the book ahead of time were pretty good. So that one's really worth it. And the thing about the first book and the second book is the first book I remember busting out laughing like all the time. I mean, it was really, really well written and a lot of fun to read. The second one is a little different in that it's much more straightforward science, and it doesn't necessarily go for the jugular as much as the first book, but is much more grounded in much more of a scientific style. And was that really the goal of the second one, to differentiate it from just that kind of snarky first one?
it's much more of a science book, because there was a lot more science to cover. You know, I was just debunking bad science in the first book to an extent, and that's can be done in a certain way, but yeah, you know, really I wanted to get to the heart of a lot of our misunderstandings about science, and really communicating some of the science of weight gain, which is not generally talked about because it doesn't fit with a sort of commercially driven narrative. And just sort of bring that to life a bit more, because I think there's a lot of stuff that, you know, a huge amount of research, which is very valuable, which has been done, but isn't necessarily communicated all the time. So it is much more of a science book than the previous one. But yeah, I hope there's a few jokes in there still. I still like to try and make people laugh. But, and I also, you know, these are serious issues, and I often, you know, have quite sort of polemic arguments and get a bit carried away sometimes, I think.
Yeah, sorry for the chicken in the background.
All right.
Okay, but let's talk a little bit about the science in this, and lately the hot area of science, or maybe hot or confusing, is the idea of the microbiome. And many people have said, well, the microbiome is, you know, and we've heard the microbiome be considered everything from just a bunch of bacteria that like to live inside of us to something that is the ultimate steering force of all physiology and thought. And so somewhere in between, there's probably some reality. And so what say you about the microbiome?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's obviously the hot area of well, all sorts of science, especially nutrition science at the moment. And it's, you know, it is an important thing. It's a fascinating thing. But is, you know, when you have those sort of hot areas of science, they are things that get misinterpreted. They're things that get misused, and they're things that people will exploit for financial gain. There's plenty of people trying to persuade me to send off samples to have my microbiome tested at the moment. I'm not sure what they're expecting. I'm going to find out about from that, because, you know, I think the thing about microbiome, and especially in regards to obesity, which is where I did most of my sort of research for the book, and but also generally, is, you know, people need to understand that there is, you know, are correlations between the microbiome and various different conditions and various different things, but, you know, those are correlations, and we don't know the direction of causality always, and sometimes that's very difficult to define. So, you know, there's some evidence that certain, you know, aspects of the microbiome, certain types of bacteria or combinations of bacteria or sort of diversity of different types of bacteria have an association with, say, obesity or, say, type 2 diabetes or various conditions. But we just don't know enough about the direction of causality. And, you know, because the confounder is always diet. You know, if you eat a diet with lots of fiber and lots of vegetables, that's generally a pretty good diet, which is good for lots of different health outcomes. That's also a pretty good diet for having a diverse microbiome. So, you know, you've got a big confounder there with diet. And the odds are that there's multi-way relationships, and it's quite complex. But with microbiome, people are kind of saying, you know, this is the answer. This is the thing that's really sort of defining why people are gaining weight or why people develop certain conditions. But actually, it's often more likely that it's a factor that is related to, you know, sort of diet and other health conditions, and is affected by diet and other health conditions. So, you know, science, people at the cutting edge of this science don't fully understand the direction of causality when it comes to the microbiome. And, you know, there's certainly no known microbiome that is correlated to obesity. You can't say this is an obesogenic microbiome. You know, that just, there's not enough research to actually say that. But there's loads and loads of people sort of selling, you know, diets which are going to change your microbiome and diet, you know, and it's just, you know, it's just, we just don't know enough. We're just stepping ahead of the science and saying, you know, this is the cause of all things, and this is the, you know, but actually we just don't know enough, and the people at the very cutting edge of this science don't know enough. But there's so many people trying to sell us diets based on, you know, how they're going to manipulate your microbiome, and that's just ridiculous. I think we should eat lots of fiber, and that's a good thing. You know, and that's a good thing for feeding your microbiome, and it's a good thing for general health. But, you know, to sort of break it down and go into it so tightly and say this is the, you know, this microbiome issue is causing this and that, we just don't know enough yet. And I wish that people would just kind of sort of step back and say, you don't have to have this sort of scientific explanation for eating lots of vegetables. Just do that, because I think we kind of know that's a good thing.
Yeah, the most compelling work I've seen on microbiome have been associations with specific microbiome constituents and the blood and the response blood glucose response to carbohydrate. And that's been kind of compelling work out of Israel, where they actually do show that there's certain people who, you know, are overweight and they look like they're a mess, and you would guess that they would be the ones with the, you know, sporting type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome, yet they metabolize glucose perfectly. No problem. You can give them anything, and they, and their blood their glucose tolerance test matches that of anybody else, of someone who's in, you know, perfect insulin regulatory areas. And some of that does correlate very tightly with microbiome. And there's companies there that actually can do some pretty tight tests to give you ideas about, you know, whether or not you're in those classes. The funny part is, though, is I think you know whether or not you can. You can metabolize glucose by whether or not you're diabetic or not. And so in a way, it kind of chases its tail. But you know, why it's compelling, I think there's a lot more that needs to be done, as you say. But what's going on? In your book, there was an interesting part about Amsterdam. And so what was the major thrust of the discussion of the food there and how that works, or diets work, especially with respect to children?
Yeah, you know, I mean, as I said before, I believe, and I don't think it's that controversial, to be honest, that, you know, obesity and health inequalities are complex systemic issues which need addressing at a system level rather than, you know, some sort of very specific top-down intervention. And, but, you know, those sort of system-level interventions are quite, you know, they feel a bit woolly sometimes. They also feel a bit like... You know, sometimes the criticism of system level interventions is, you know, that it involves addressing everything at once, and it allows big companies to say, oh, well, it's not our fault, it's a system problem, you know. And that's the criticism, and I understand that criticism. But, you know, there are occasional examples of good system level interventions, and one of the best ones is the Amsterdam Childhood Obesity Project, which happened, you know, over the last few years. Basically took a strong act of political leadership to sort of stand back and say, we want to address childhood obesity. We're going to do it at a system level. So what we're going to do, instead of sort of top-down interventions like we're going to put a tax on people and we're going to have a big public information campaign, what they did first, because they considered this the most important thing, was to address societal inequalities, which were, you know, really the drivers of health inequalities. And, you know, so worked with people at a community level, and we've sort of brought together all the people across Amsterdam who are working to help communities, and sort of gave them extra resources sometimes, but also just brought things together to say everything we're doing to help children in Amsterdam is going to be focused on helping them and live healthier lifestyles. And it's going to be focused on taking the people in the most deprived and the most vulnerable areas and giving them the most help and helping them, you know, have slightly better lives. So making healthier decisions, making decisions to perhaps do some exercise or perhaps eat a better quality diet, actually makes sense. And also, instead of like really aggressive prohibition of unhealthy things, what they did was make sure that the landscape in which people were making food decisions was completely either completely equal or weighted towards the healthy decision. So instead of sort of banning vending machines selling Coca-Cola, they would probably allow the vending machines to be there, but make sure that there was always healthier options, that it was always tap water available free, or not tap water, drinking water available free, and helps people who perhaps were more vulnerable or more prone to bad decision makings, empowered them to make better decisions for their health and gave them lives where those decisions made sense. And so that sounds like sort of a complex thing to do, and it is a complex thing to do. It requires, you know, quite a massive coordination of all the existing social care and healthcare and education infrastructure in the city, and bringing that all together with a single goal of helping address childhood obesity. But it's probably the one really good example of an intervention at that sort of level, which has actually worked really well, because it's not only brought down levels of childhood obesity in Amsterdam, it's also reduced the inequality between, you know, between levels along socioeconomic grounds. So in most developed countries these days, lower socioeconomic groups tend to have a higher prevalence of obesity, especially childhood obesity. It's less so of men. It's mostly women and children who seem to be more vulnerable in lower socioeconomic groups. And in Amsterdam, that inequality has been reduced, and it's probably the only place in the world where that inequality has been reduced. This is it's an incredibly complex thing. It's incredibly hard to do, but that's what it takes to actually make successful interventions.
Well, that's one side of that scale, right? You can have some larger social interventions to try to bring about elements of systemic change. But let's go all the way to the other end of that spectrum. You know, I can say that I was very fortunate to grow up in a house with a mother who was a fantastic cook, who from the time I was a little kid was helping to prepare meals and learning about how to assemble something to eat for the family or cook a dish, not from a cookbook, but from just kind of understanding the ratios and what the different things do inside of a dish. And have people really lost, or are we losing, the ability to simply cook from scratch?
I think there's some evidence that that might be happening. But I also think sometimes, you know, you have to accept a bit of that to an extent, because that goes with a lot of positive societal changes. It goes with the changing role of women in society. It goes with, you know, more people entering the workplace, and it goes with, you know, a lot of positive things. And we maybe lose some of the skills of the past. But what we really need to do, instead of just sort of imagining that we desperately need everybody to return to the past, we need to understand that for a lot of people, that spending hours cooking in the kitchen, however pleasurable it might be, and however much, you know, it's something that I definitely enjoy myself, it's just not possible for everybody in the society we have now. and you know, it probably will not be for, you know, possible again in the society. So we need to find ways of helping people to lead better lives and lead healthier lives within that infrastructure. And, you know, for some people, it's never been possible. You know, for some people who have, you know, sort of complex needs, and for some people who have disabilities, and for some people who have, you know, just sort of various different reasons why they can't cook, that's never been possible. And what we have now is an environment where, you know, that's not necessarily always leading to food insecurity. You know, we have much better food security than we used to, especially for vulnerable people. And you know, we shouldn't forget that sort of progress is important. I love cooking, and I think it'd be great if we could get loads of people back cooking. But you have to understand that that's not necessarily possible for everybody, and we just have to try and find ways of helping people to lead a healthier life within that sort of modern societal infrastructure. And, you know, sometimes that's going to be decisions which don't always sort of play well with certain types of you know, certain types of social commenters who want us to, you know, believe that this sort of artisanal return to the earth and return to nature and return to the way things used to be is the only way we should be going forward. You know, there has been progress, and a lot of that progress has been positive, and a lot of that has depended on food system infrastructure changes. And we just need to find a way to live better within that, rather than thinking we should return to the past.
Well, that's when when you talk about the larger social, you know, framework of this. You know, I'm here in the American South, and I'm in a I work in a city that has substantial infrastructure. You can go to a convenience store on the corner, and you have more choices than you do at the grocery store, which is out where I live, out in a rural area. You know, you have a large amount, at least in the States and in some areas, where there really is a question of food deserts. And in the poor areas of the South, even rural areas, not even talking the cities, you don't necessarily have access to fresh fruits and vegetables at any appreciable level. You have the things that survive post-harvest well, so things like apples, and you can get that. But, you know, things even like bananas or lettuce can be kind of rare. And in the cities, you even see this. So, especially, you know, where you may have a considerable population that is isolated from the option of even having fresh fruits and vegetables to work from. And when you look at the correlations and you look at where obesity is rampant, it tends to fit very well with these areas where there just isn't access to food choice.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's much. I mean, it's actually much more of a problem in the US, and food deserts have been sort of proposed as one of the big causes of obesity. I think the US is quite specific in that. In the UK, it's slightly different because we don't necessarily have the larger spaces, and societies are generally not sort of as geographically sort of disparate. But there are often those sort of systemic issues which make it very difficult for people to eat well. I would probably argue that certainly where I live and it's certainly improved over the past 30 or 40 years rather than got worse, because when I was growing up we had far less access to a far smaller variety of fruits and vegetables and fresh meat and fresh fish and all those sort of things. We have much better access to food now than we did. But, there are certainly areas where access is very difficult. How much of that is caused by, the actual physical infrastructure, and how much is that caused by, people leading difficult lives not having the demand for those things, I'm not sure. But I don't think there's enough focus when it comes to interventions from a government level. There's not enough focus on sort of promoting people to sell fruits and vegetables and offer better choice for people. For instance, in the UK, I don't know how it is in the US, but in the UK, the rates, the tax you pay on a business are exactly the same if you're opening like a takeaway as they are if you're opening a fruit and vegetable shop. And that seems ridiculous, really, doesn't it? But there's no, the people are, you look at one business is going to be more profitable and it's going to have better demand. But, you can think how you could easily manufacture incentives for people to open businesses selling healthy food. But there's so little focus on that because the focus tends to be on sort of, going for the people involved, looking at individuals and telling them they need to make better choices rather than helping create an infrastructure where they can make better choices and better choices make sense.
Well, tell me a little bit more about food addiction and how this plays a role in chronic obesity.
Yeah, it's something that I talked earlier about how different individual nutrients aren't necessarily, it's not a very good idea to focus on individual nutrients like fat or like sugar or like carbs. Sometimes that leads people to say, well, it's about food, and basically our environment now has lots of foods which are addictive. They're like addictive drugs and people can't stop eating them. And that, that focus will always be pointed at, industrially produced food like chocolate. Say these things are addictive like drugs. People just can't help themselves, and they have no willpower around them. And that's kind of a common narrative, which I think is pretty much accepted by a lot of people, that we have these addictive foods. I'm quite cynical about that, if I'm honest. I don't think there's much evidence that really supports food. There's not a single substance or a single, people talk about sugar a lot of the time. That's not an addictive substance. Otherwise, people would just end up eating sugar out of a bag. There's no individual ingredient which is addictive. But some people have if they have a particularly emotive connection to certain foods, like, say, so it could be fried chicken or it could be pizza or it could be chocolate or it could be, any number of things, donuts or something. That might have a particular emotional resonance for them, and sometimes their desire to eat that, often just sort of fill some sort of emotional hole, can sort of trump their appetite, and they will develop a sort of quasi-addictive relationship with food. Sometimes that results in binge eating disorder, which is an eating disorder, and we shouldn't think of that as a food addiction. That's it's an eating disorder, which is a sign of more fundamental problems people have. But that can develop almost addiction-like behavior around certain foods and cause sort of binge eating. This is not a sign of a particularly addictive food environment. This is a sign of people who are suffering from sort of severe emotional problems. And binge eating disorder is linked to sort of childhood trauma and childhood abuse and all sorts of other sort of serious problems that people are facing. people might think it's quite unusual, quite rare, and it is reasonably unusual, reasonably rare. But in the most obese people, in people who, like, say the population of people who are going into bariatric surgery in the UK, well over half, probably about 60%, are suffering from binge eating disorder, which is a serious eating disorder. And so what we do to those people is just tell them it's all about their willpower and tell them they're just weak-willed, and they cut their, you know, often you see them described as being disgusting or a shame on society, when these are people suffering from serious sort of trauma and abuse and mental illness. You know, we just have so little compassion for that. We just have so little sympathy for it, I think. And I just more than anything in the book, I kind of appeal to people to just have a bit more compassion and understanding that different people are going through different problems, and we shouldn't be judging them for their size and their shape. We should be judging them as you know, people, human people going through very human problems, and trying to address those problems rather than just saying, oh, it's simple, you should have just eaten less.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, because if you look at eating disorders in the other direction, like anorexia or bulimia, it seems like there is a lot of compassion for that and a lot of understanding that it is part of a spectrum of mental health or previous trauma, or there's other components that require therapy and therapeutic interventions, mental health therapy. And yet, and that seems to be the case. Whereas people who are suffering in the other direction, we tend to either vilify or somehow compartmentalize and just say, well, you know, take the pie out of your mouth. You know, it's really, isn't that an interesting dichotomy that we think of it in two different ways?
I think it's very interesting. But what I would also say is, you know, that is not necessarily always been the case. I would say that eating disorders, anorexia and bulimia, they used to be, you know, in my memory, certainly, it used to be a lot of people used to say, oh, it's just silly girls who are just too vain and want to lose some weight, and just not fundamentally not understanding that it was a serious and potentially fatal mental illness. People were vilified in the past, but we have a better understanding of that now. But with sort of weight gain and obesity, we just don't have that understanding yet, because it's so ingrained within society that this is a problem of willpower, and it's a problem of people's willpower breaking down, and they just need to be better. They just need to be, you know, sort of improve their sort of ability to control themselves. But it's obviously not that. But we have this. We still have that ingrained. But I think your example means to me says that, actually, there is capacity to change. There is capacity for us to get better at this and help actually work on helping people, but it just takes time.
Well, that's a really great point to go out on. And what's next on your radar, and what's the next project?
Well, you like this one. My next project is I'm certainly doing a lot of writing and hoping to work towards another book, which is going to be about the sustainability of food supply and the environmental impact of food, and also just again looking at how that's misused and misunderstood, and how that's used to sell stuff to people, and you know, the things that we generally get wrong about that. But also, you know, without trying to hide that there are very serious issues that need addressing. I just want to look at the science and realize how people are manipulating it to sell stuff through.
No, that's an excellent topic, and something near and dear to my heart for sure. If people want to know more about you or read your work or follow you on social media, where do they look?
My biggest social media presence is probably on Twitter, where I am the Angry Chef. I'm one Angry Chef, and I have my blog, which is the Angry Chef blog, where I tend to sort of contribute regularly to that and to various different publications I write for in the UK and internationally. And of course, you can buy both my books, which is The Angry Chef and The Truth About Fat.
Yeah, very good and highly recommended. Both of them serve a very important purpose. I've enjoyed both of them. The first one, you know, just great for debunking. The second one for a scientific discussion of these multifaceted problems associated with fat and its consequences. So thank you so much for joining me, Anthony. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. As usual, do a review on iTunes or your place where you consume media. They make the podcast look a little more attractive to the casual consumer who's just looking for some new content. And our reviews are always really nice and really appreciated. So thank you very much for that. And we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.